Welcome, good evening. Tonight, our topic is, have the machines taken over? And this is related to technology that now so many of us are using in our lives. AI is used by millions of citizens, consumers, businesses, government departments around the world, and the future is here. This is something that is in our daily lives and experience, even if we don't always recognize it. But while AI and technology is being feted as perhaps one of the most transformative opportunities of the 21st century, there are real anxieties too. In our rush to employ this technology in our daily lives, are we overlooking some of the challenges and the risks that it brings with it? Are we really in control, or have the machines taken over? I'm really delighted this evening to be in discussion with Stuart Russell, a British professor who literally wrote the book on artificial intelligence. His book, Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, is the standard text in AI. It's been translated into 13 languages, used in over 1,300 universities across the world in 118 countries. To give Stuart a little introduction, his past, he studied physics as an undergraduate at Oxford before moving to Stanford for his PhD in computer science. He then joined the faculty of the University of California in Berkeley, where he is professor of electrical engineering and computer sciences and the director of the Center for Human-Compatible AI. His current concerns include the threat of autonomous weapons and the long-term future of AI and its relation to humanity, topics really of a scale befitting the stage that we are on today. Intimidatingly, as I was preparing for the event this evening, Stuart was summarized by my colleagues as one of the very few people in the world who seems to be right about everything. So gathering my courage in my hands, I'd like to welcome Stuart to come and speak with us. And just before we begin, to give you a sense of the outline of the evening, Stuart and I will have a conversation, but then we're very keen to open to the floor and take questions and get a conversation going. The more vigorous the questions, the warmer we will all feel with the temperature in here. So we will begin, but do be thinking where you would like to take the conversation. So Stuart, I wonder if we might begin just by a few definitions. What is artificial intelligence?
So I think we have to begin to answer that question by asking what is human intelligence, because that was the model for machine intelligence. So human intelligence we normally think of as the ability to act in a way that can be expected to achieve your objectives. And this is the definition that was then transferred to machines, that we think of machines as intelligent if they act in ways that can be expected to achieve their objectives. And that's been the classical definition of AI since the beginning. And I'm actually arguing right now in a book that I'm writing that that was a big mistake. And I'll explain why later on. But for the time being, we'll think of it as machines that act in ways that can be expected to achieve their objectives.
And what sort of examples do we see in the world? Perhaps the smartphones that we use, the autonomous cars that we might be driving, what sort of illustrations or embodiments of AI do we see?
So the smartphone is a good example. I found my way here guided by my phone. If you could imagine in the old days, if I had a big paper map with my umbrella, the map is getting rained on, and it's dark, and I'm trying to read it, and I'm probably extremely unhappy about this whole process of navigating. Now my phone does all that for me. It knows the geography of London. It can choose routes automatically to get me where I want to go, and it knows when to give me advice and tell me to turn left. And all of that is AI. We think of it as just a completely routine thing now. But this was all based on research done in the AI community over the last 50 years. And self-driving cars, you know, in 10 years' time, probably we'll think of those as completely routine. Just as we think of a lift. You know, when you get in a lift and you press 5 and you get up to floor 5, you don't think of that as a miracle. But to, you know, someone 200 years ago, that would be a miracle. In 10 years' time, we'll think of the automated car in the same way we think of a lift. You get in, you say where you want to go, and you get out.
And what has changed? What's brought artificial intelligence to such prominence in the last few years? Is this an entirely novel technology?
So the field started officially in 1956, and we had a number of false starts, and the problem turned out to be much, much more difficult than we thought. But in the last 5 years, three of what we might think of as holy grails of AI have actually been captured. One of them is the ability to recognize objects in images. Another one is speech recognition. And a third is machine translation. So by some metrics, machines have now reached human-level performance in these areas, or even exceeded it. And this is the result of progress in a branch of AI called machine learning, which means that rather than trying to program the capability into the machine directly, just as Alan Turing predicted in 1950, the best way to write the program is not to write it, but to write a learning algorithm, and then to provide information to the learning algorithm in the form of examples, and then the learning algorithm essentially writes the program that recognizes the image or recognizes the speech. And so this is how we're building most AI systems these days.
And I have a sense that AI is already here, but it's also not yet, in that so many of the projections of the future, often news articles including images of the Terminator, are anticipating far more advanced capabilities. What's the difference between what we have now and what might be coming?
So I should mention I have a formal agreement with journalists that I won't talk to them unless they agree not to put a Terminator robot in the article. At the moment, we have very impressive capabilities, but we are far from what we think of as human-level AI, which is the long-term goal of the field. And interestingly, you know, one of the founders of the field, Herb Simon, in 1963, predicted that within 10 years, we would have machines that covered the full range of human intellectual capabilities. And that turned out to be very much an optimistic estimate. So there are still major breakthroughs that have to happen before we reach anything that resembles human-level AI. One example is the ability to really understand the content of language. So we can translate between languages using machines, but actually through a very superficial mapping between the form of one language and the form of another, but without any intermediate understanding of what is actually being said. And when, of course, humans do machine translation, they understand the content and then they re-express it. And right now, machines are not very good at understanding the content of language. If that goal is reached, then, for example, we would have systems that could then read and understand everything the human race has ever written. And this is something that a human being can't do. It would take tens of millions of people to read the entire output of human history in a single year, but machines would be able to do it in a few hours once we have that capability. And then you could have something that you could then query all of human knowledge, and it would be able to synthesize and integrate and answer questions that no human being has ever been able to answer because they haven't read and been able to put together and join the dots between things that have remained separate throughout history. So The potential is incredible when these breakthroughs occur. And we're seeing one of the breakthroughs of a particular kind of machine learning algorithm. And we're seeing that playing out right now.
And in the here and now, you mentioned autonomous cars, you've mentioned smartphones, but the beneficial possibilities of this technology are really quite broad. Education and medical diagnostics. What do you see as some of the illustrations of those benefits of AI?
So I think education is a good example because we've been using AI systems to do tutoring for a long time, but they've been hamstrung by two things. One is they have had no common language between the machine and the pupil. And the other is that they don't understand anything about what they're teaching. So it would be like me trying to teach molecular biology in Laos, in Laotian, which I don't understand, right? And I don't know anything about molecular biology, and I don't speak Laotian, so I wouldn't be a very good tutor. So if we have breakthroughs on the understanding of language and the internal capabilities to represent and reason with knowledge about molecular biology or neutrino physics or whatever it might be, you'd have the capability to give high-quality tutoring on any topic to everybody on Earth at almost no cost. And that's one of the major things that's holding back human development, particularly in developing countries, is the inability to access education or even to provide education. So that's just one of the things that we could have.
Do you think there will be any endeavor untouched by AI? Is this something like electricity that transforms almost every aspect of work and leisure, or is that too ubiquitous, exaggerating the impact of this technology?
So I think in the long run, it's much, much more influential and has a higher impact than electricity. I've described it as the biggest event in human history, if and when we achieve human-level AI. IJ Good, who was a British statistician, wrote a very famous paper in 1965 about what he called the intelligence explosion. So one of the things that AI systems would be able to do is to redesign themselves to be better AI systems. And so you could see the sort of very rapid takeoff in the capabilities of AI systems. And he described it as the last invention that man ever need make. Because after that, the machines would do all the other inventing that we need.
The title for the series is Embracing Global Challenges, and just heard perhaps the biggest challenge of human history. So these are large topics and opportunities. I wonder if the benefits are so broad-based, potentially so transformative, is there a flip side as well? Why do people tend to worry about AI so much? The headlines do repeat a pretty broad-based anxiety, and we've heard Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, others be relatively apocalyptic in their language about the future of AI. Are we right to worry? Are the machines taking over?
So, interestingly, Alan Turing himself gave a lecture, I was actually on the BBC Radio 3 in 1951, where he was quite matter-of-fact about it, that at some point you'd have to expect that machine thinking would exceed our capabilities, and then where should we be? You know, if we're lucky, we might be able to switch off the power at strategic moments, but in any case, our species would be humbled. And this is a very natural fear. So I think even without all the Terminator robots that the media is throwing at us, it's a very natural fear that if you make something that's more intelligent than you are, it's not going to be very easy for you to retain control over it forever. And that's the first source of unease about this.
I'd love to explore that in a bit more detail, but perhaps we can focus on the AI that we have now, our smartphones, the common applications that we see, search engine technology, even insurance companies using AI to process various aspects of pricing or claims, applying for mortgages, even the operations of government departments. Is any of that an area for concern before we get to the further ahead concerns?
So the point being that government departments were functioning really well until the machines came along, is it? I think there are a number of areas of current concern that the AI community is actually taking seriously now that they've been pointed out.
Could you give some illustrations?
So one of them is the problem of bias. What tends to happen, for example, in selecting candidates for job interviews based on resumes, giving loans to people, the algorithms themselves and even the programmers may be completely free of bias, but the data on which the algorithms are trained reflects all the biases that society has been inflicting on people. For example, if you look at repayment rates, because of all the economic bias that we apply to minorities, they may have a lower rate of repayment because it's harder for them to find good jobs and they have to deal with a lot of other problems that more privileged classes might not have to deal with. So to the machine, it looks like, oh, there's a group of people here who don't repay at the same rate, and therefore we should charge them more or refuse their application altogether. So the machine ends up replicating or sometimes even amplifying biases that society already has.
Is this a problem largely around opacity? The fact that I suspect that many of us have been subject to machine learning algorithms and decisions that organizations may or may not have made on that basis, but I suspect also few of us are aware of that. Is that the key problem, or is it technically a very hard problem to solve, something like bias?
So technically, actually, it's not hard to solve. There are various definitions of what you mean by fair outcomes, but for each of those definitions, it's possible to write algorithms that achieve those outcomes. That may come at a cost. I mean, the cost is the cost of, in some sense, reparations for historical bias, that in order to, for example, to give loans at the same cost to a group that historically has had a lower repayment rate, it's going to cost you something, at least initially. So we have to make a social policy choice that we can have a fair outcome based on specially designed algorithms, but we have to be willing to pay for it. And so the trade-off is quite explicit. We can quantify how much fairness you get and how much it's going to cost you and so on. But these are not difficult problems to solve. I think the main issue actually is making the broader technical community aware of these definitions and these solutions and then making sure that the policy decisions get made. There are other things going on that are perhaps more subtle and problematic. So one of them, I've been calling it the click-through catastrophe, which has been happening on social media. What social media would like is that you click on things because that's how they get paid. So they write algorithms which try to find out what you're going to click on and then can send you more of it. And that sounds fine. And so these algorithms are maximizing click-through. But it turned out that they had a rather simplified model of human beings, which is that human beings are fixed in their preferences. And so if that were the case, then the algorithm would be quite reasonable. It would learn not to send you things that you don't want to look at. But in fact, people are not fixed in their preferences. And if you send them certain kinds of, for example, political articles, you are modifying their political beliefs. You're moving them in one direction or another along the political spectrum. Now, what the algorithm wants is for you to click on things. And so it will move you to wherever on the political spectrum you are most predictable, which turns out to be the extreme points. So the effect of these perfectly innocent algorithms was to move everybody to the nearest extreme point on the political spectrum where their political beliefs are very, very predictable, and then they can be fed. You know, a whole industry sprung up to feed them the kinds of materials that they're likely to click on. My friend Max Tegmark likes to call these a bunch of dudes chugging Red Bull, basically rolled out software that has had a really pernicious effect on the entire world, because billions of people have been modified in their political beliefs as a result.
And is this a problem of technology, or is it a problem of culture and values of the people who are creating that technology?
I think I don't think they had the intent of sort of breaking democracy and possibly breaking the climate too at the same time. I think they had the intent of maximizing click-through, and they didn't have any. There was no third party saying, "Are you sure that's a good idea?" You know, there's just them and the 5 billion people out there who are being fed this stuff. And I think what we're trying to do is to get the AI community to understand this failure mode of specifying objectives and then optimizing them, which sounds reasonable until you realize that the objectives are very, very incomplete description of the whole of human preferences, and that there are side effects to optimizing almost any objective. And they need to think very carefully, just as we do when we design drugs. You don't have a bunch of guys chugging Red Bull designing drugs and then, you know, sending out 20 billion pills to everybody. There's a whole lot of processes they have to go through to check that there are no side effects, that it's efficacious, that it's beneficial, that it's safe, before they're allowed to do that. And in the digital world, there's none of that. And so I think we need to take, we as an AI community need to take our responsibilities much more seriously. And part of it is just we're very young. For the first 50 years of the field, none of our stuff worked, and nobody bought it. And we were all playing with toys in our labs. And it's just a very rapid transition to a situation where we can have these global impacts because people are buying our stuff and it works.
Is this a problem for the technical community? Or the conversation about AI sometimes seems to resemble the conversation around globalization in the 1990s, that this is a development that is inexorable, that it's highly technical, that there may be some winners and some losers, but this is the tide of history, but some very clever people are going to make sure that nothing goes wrong. And with globalization, that ended a little unhappily in 2008 and even before then. Is this something for the technical community, or is this a more broad-based conversation that the whole of society needs to engage in? And how would that happen with such an abstruse subject?
I think absolutely society needs to be involved in this, because society is what suffers when things go wrong. And also, I think, should have a role in saying what we do want to have happen. You know, do we want all of our children to be addicted to incredibly well-designed games on smartphones or not? You know, do we want to all spend our lives in virtual reality slaying dragons? The difficulty is that at the moment, governments have very little understanding of how it works and what the negative consequences or positive consequences might be. I'm pleased to say that governments are certainly waking up to the issue. International organizations, the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, and others are waking up to the issue, and they're forming global councils and world summits as fast as you can name people to put on them.
Well, I think even today, the UK government announced the creation of the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, which is built to look into these issues and try and perhaps begin to formulate maybe not just a regulatory response, but a framework of tools and language to help more people engage and perhaps interact with some things that have been rather opaque and hidden until now?
Yes, I think things could go well, but, you know, generals always fight the last war, and governments always deal with the problem that's already happened rather than the ones that are going to happen.
We need to look and prepare
because, you know, some of these impacts are going to take place over the medium to long term. You know, so for example, the impact on employment. You know, many economists think this is the biggest economic problem that the world faces. But to figure out what to do and then to actually put in place the changes in economic structure, in our education system, in our whole scientific research base, these things take decades, and we probably need to start yesterday working on that problem.
One gets the sense, partly because of the immense possibilities within AI, that it's a technology almost indistinguishable from magic. And I wonder whether you think that it is likely that all of the hopes and expectations vested in AI as a technology are likely to come to pass. There is a thought experiment with Isaac Newton looking at a smartphone and being entirely dazzled by the fact that the world's information was in the palm of his hand, and he had access to everything with a few clicks of his finger, and then the battery dies. And he wonders where on earth that's all gone, such a pedestrian mode of failure to accompany such a magical piece of kit. And I wonder whether some of the same difficulties that Isaac Newton had in anticipating the failure of something like a smartphone, we might also have in anticipating some of the limitations of general AI before us? Do you think that...
I think that as I mentioned, there are several major breakthroughs that have to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, those could come very quickly. So when people say, oh, you know, this is centuries in the future, or maybe some people say it's impossible that we'll ever have general purpose AI. And I'd like to refer back to what happened in the history of nuclear physics. The consensus of the physics establishment was that even though they knew how much energy there was stored in atoms, that it was impossible to ever release that energy. And in fact, Ernest Rutherford, who was the man who split the atom, the most famous nuclear physicist, gave a speech on September 11th, 1933, in Leicester, saying exactly that. You know, a questioner asked him, you know, in 20 or 30 years' time, could we expect that we might be able to access this immense quantity of energy? And he said, no, it's completely impossible. It's moonshine that we could ever do that. And then the next morning, Leo Szilard invented the neutron-induced nuclear chain reaction. So less than 24 hours later, the problem was basically solved. So it's very, very, very hard to predict when these conceptual breakthroughs are going to happen. I know people who are very serious, very well-respected researchers in the field who sincerely believe that it could be as soon as 5 years from now. I know others who think it could be thousands of years. But the consensus is probably sometime in this century.
And if we are to be ready for that, if regulation or even the social conversation is to be prepared for those kind of changes, as well as the applications that we have now, what sort of ethical thinking might be involved? It feels like our technology continues to develop at pace, but we rely on ethical frameworks that are centuries old. How should we approach the question of ethics when it comes to these new technologies?
So I think Let me go back to the definition that I gave at the beginning. The idea that a machine is intelligent to the extent that its actions can be expected to achieve its objectives. And when we follow that definition, we are obliged to put the objective into the machine. It doesn't have objectives of its own. And this is how we build and deploy AI systems. So machine learning systems are designed with an objective of minimizing prediction error. And we've seen failures of that, you know, when Google's algorithm mistakes a person for a gorilla, that's because they forgot to specify that that's an extra expensive kind of mistake to make. This failure mode of misspecifying objectives has been known to human history. You know, King Midas had that problem. You know, anytime anyone in any culture asks the gods for something, they end up regretting it because they ask for not quite the right thing. So King Midas wanted everything to turn to gold that he touched, and his family and his food and his drink turned to gold, and he dies in misery and starvation. The lamp that you rob, and the genie gives you three wishes, and the third wish is always, please undo the first two wishes because I messed up. So in order to understand how to make AI systems that we want to be beneficial to humans, we have to understand what beneficial means. And this is the same question that moral philosophers have been asking themselves for centuries. You know, going back to Jeremy Bentham and utilitarians, and even before that, what constitutes a right action? You know, and we want our machines to do a right action. And so we have to answer this question. One thing that's clear is that because it's so hard to specify what it is that humans want correctly, the machines are going to have to be uncertain about what is the true objective. Right? So even though they can be designed to the extent they can to maximize the satisfaction of human preferences, which we can think of as the definition of beneficial, they won't know what that means. They won't know what our preferences are. And if you design machines this way, it turns out that they are then forced to be deferential to humans, because it's the human who can provide information, either in the form of wishes or criticism, that will help the machine learn more about human preferences. And so if the human says, don't do that, the machine has an incentive to obey, because the machine doesn't want to violate human preferences, and this is giving the machine some more information about human preferences. If the machine believes it knows the objective correctly, it has no incentive to listen to the human anymore, because it's pursuing the objective that's defined. And even if the human is saying, you know, stop, you're destroying the world, well, those are just words, right? They don't matter if the machine believes it's correct in its actions. So this notion, we can think of it as a kind of a machine humility, that it's obliged to try to satisfy human preferences, but it knows that it doesn't know the full extent of those preferences, and therefore is going to be deferential. So that's the first part of a kind of machine morality, if you want to think of it that way. But then we have the problem that there's more than one person in the world. So if there was just one person, I think we would say, okay, problem solved, but there's more than one person. And this is the reason for moral philosophy. We wouldn't bother with moral philosophy if there was only one person. It's how do you trade off the preferences of multiple people who may be in conflict with each other. There may be resource constraints, so you can't make everybody emperor of the universe, even if they want to be, because you're going to have one emperor. And so you've got to figure out how these trade-offs are going to get made. And machines are going to have to do this. They can't just work for their owner, because they also have to respect the preferences of other people. A self-driving car isn't just interested in getting its passenger to the destination. They also have to defer to other drivers to make space, to follow the rules, and so on. So how do we solve that problem? And the utilitarians had an answer, which is essentially the greatest good of the greatest number, or roughly sort of add up all the preferences and try to come up with the maximal total satisfaction But then moral philosophers have been arguing about that for the last 200 years and saying, well, what about, you know, what about if you had lots and lots and lots more people all living a barely tolerable life? Well, that would sort of add up to more, but that's probably not what we'd want. And so arguably the moral philosophers have been doing the work of debugging the formula, if you like, of getting rid of the possible loopholes in the formula that AI systems can use to meet the preferences of the human race at large. And, you know, there's a little example that I give in talks where, you know, you go out, you buy your domestic robot, you bring it home, you take it out of the box, you switch it on, and you say, "Hi, domestic robot. Hi. I'm really hungry. Can you make me some dinner?" And the robot says, "Well, you know, I calculate that there are people in Somalia who are in much greater need than you are. So I'm going to Somalia to help them, and you can make your own dinner." All right. So that's a very, very impressive robot that works on the behalf of humanity. But of course, you'd never buy a robot that instantly disappeared off to Somalia. So these are some of the moral conundrums that we're going to face. And the nice thing about AI is, it's not just a matter of discussing and writing books. You actually have to write the software, and it actually has to make decisions on the basis of that. So we are going to make mistakes, but I think that we will create machines that perhaps even could set an example to us of how to behave in a moral, altruistic, and completely unselfish way.
Perhaps an opportunity for theologians as well as philosophers to apply their thinking. Stuart, when you were defining AI, you very much took the analogy with human intelligence. And it seems as though machines are sometimes constructed in competition with humans, partly with cognition as the denominator for humanity, for the value that we place in those machines and in people. But you know, humans and machines are different, even if they're thinking.
I hope so.
Machines.
Yeah.
What is it, aside from intelligence, that distinguishes people and machines? What complementarity might exist rather than just who can play chess better?
So I think one important point to make, which some people apparently disagree with, is that there is no moral value in the existence of machines. No matter how intelligent they are, no matter what poetry they write, their existence has no moral value because they are not subjects. They have no subjective experience of suffering or of pleasure or anything else. So some people say, you know, fine, we should bequeath the earth to our machines because they're more intelligent and therefore they deserve the earth and we don't. I think this is complete nonsense. When you think about what is the role of human beings going to be, I think that's where this question leads. You know, what is the role of human beings going to be in a world where machines can do everything, or at least that's the story, that machines can do everything better than we can. One of the things that human beings have is value to each other. There are things that human beings can do to make each other's lives better that machines can't do. We also actually have an intrinsic advantage because we have very similar brains. It may not seem that way. You know, often we get into arguments and we think, what are you thinking? But in fact, our brains are so similar that when we're talking to each other, we're actually running a simulation of the other person's brain using our brain as the substrate of that simulation because they work in so similar a way. And machines can do this to each other. They can actually run each other's code, so they can do it even better than we can. But they don't have a brain that's like ours, so they can't simulate our minds. So you can call it empathy or sort of a common humanity or whatever you want to call it. We have that intrinsic advantage, which is, I think, one of the things that enables us to be of value to each other. And when you think about it, in the long run, when you know mental and physical labor are obsolete, our role in the, you know, I don't even sure if the economy is the right word, but let's call it society or economy or whatever. Our role is going to be in how we can provide value to each other by improving each other's lives, by inspiring, by teaching, by consoling, by raising children or looking after the elderly. And no machine is going to do that. I mean, it may be competent, but it won't provide the same value, the same inspiration, the same emotional comfort, and so on. So if you said, you know, in a nutshell, what should government policy be to prepare humanity for this future? It should be, we need to become better people. Because by being better people, we will be able to provide more value to each other and will have a real role in our society. And that seems pretty straightforward to me. And I don't think we should be training more programmers or robot engineers. We'll have enough of those by the normal economic process. But this is something that needs to start happening now. And you know, when you think about it, how much of our science has been devoted to answering how do we do that? Like, almost none, right? It's usually left to those underfunded humanities departments or theology departments or whatever. And science concentrates on producing cell phones and rockets, which haven't so far made us very happy.
Will we be able to leave Brexit to the machines to sort out?
I was hoping Brexit wasn't going to come up tonight.
I would love to turn to you, the audience, and get some questions. Let's start, Baroness Lane Fox.
Martha, please. Thank you, that was fantastic. I'm happy we can double down on humanity. That's my default too. But I'm interested that you did not talk so much about East v. West, to be crude, in terms of value systems and building AI, you know, because arguably, whatever we're attempting in Europe, certainly in the UK versus the money, the resource pouring into Chinese development of artificial intelligence systems, and therefore, a question, the different values and ethics that will be deployed around how they intend to use it versus how we do. So I'm just very interested to hear your thoughts on China or the more malevolent authoritarian regimes that might be building the future.
Yes, I think there are many ways that AI can be misused. We could talk about autonomous weapons. We could talk about surveillance and control. So I was just in China on a press conference announcing the top 50 Chinese AI companies. And I think a fairly brave journalist asked, who are the clients? Who are the customers for these AI companies? And the answer turned out to be the Chinese state security apparatus. So they are funding and buying products from the Chinese AI companies at an enormous rate. So I think that in principle there could be 7.5 billion value systems. There's no single set of human preferences. You know, there are similarities in preferences within cultures and within families and so on, but ultimately everyone is entitled to their own preferences. I hope that the Chinese government will understand that at the point where we, you know, there's not going to be a single point, but to simplify, let's say there's a point where we achieve human-level AI. What could we do with that? You know, one of the simple things we could do, you know, with physical robots and with software systems, we could bring this, and education as well, we could bring the standard of living of everyone on Earth up to a respectable level. So in some sense, the whole notion of national competition over resources or economic power becomes completely meaningless. So every time I give a talk in China, I say, look, you can have a dominant share of a non-existent pie, or you can have a fair share of an infinite pie. Which would you rather have? You know, and I don't know if the message is getting through, but they keep inviting me back to give talks, so perhaps something is working. There's an organization called the Partnership on AI, which was started as a consortium of tech companies, but now has many, many nonprofit organizations, universities, and so on as members. And just recently, Baidu, which is one of the major Chinese IT companies, joined. And one of the tenets that they sign up to when joining is that basically, if and when we achieve human-level AI, the benefits will be shared with everybody. So it's a sign that perhaps this message is getting through, that competition is not necessarily the way to think about AI. But I take your point, the misuse of AI for surveillance and control is a serious problem in the near term.
Fantastic first question. I think we might take a couple of questions, a brace.
All important technologies of the past have allowed human beings to achieve, to carry out tasks that they were unable to do previously. So, for instance, railways allowed us to travel faster along the ground, aircraft allowed us to fly, which was impossible before, and telephones allowed us to talk to people who we couldn't see and who were thousands of miles away. How do we design AI such that it augments human intelligence rather than making us more redundant or stupid and unnecessary in the world?
Fantastic. That's a fantastic question. We can certainly design tools, and we already are building tools. The people who are playing chess, actually it's here in London, right? So Carlson and Caruana, they use computers to augment their chess capability. So probably right now they're analyzing the game that they just played and trying to figure out where they went wrong, what they could do better next time with computers to help them. So there are many, many of these AI tools. I think physicists are using them to interpret data from the Large Hadron Collider, and so on and so forth. But if you think about the classical notion of the autonomous intelligent system, that's a necessary kind of technology as well. It's not a tool that's constantly being directed by the human, because, for example, if I want a robot to look after my garden, it's got to have its own autonomous existence. I can't be telling it every blade of grass that I want it to cut one by one. It has to function when I'm away on holiday and so on and so forth. So we're going to develop the technology of autonomous intelligence. I think, in principle, AI systems, understanding that human preferences include being useful and having our own autonomy and agency, should just as Jeeves does in the Bertie Wooster novels, sometimes stand back and let us do things and make our own mistakes. Sometimes be there to catch us, when we fall. And one fear that I have is that even though the AI systems are saying, no, I'm not doing that. You need to learn how to do that for yourself, as we do with our children and their shoelaces. We may override that, because we are short-sighted. We often will prefer comfort and idleness in the short term, not realizing that in the long term we become dependent. There's an amazing story. So E.M. Forster, who wrote very famous novels like Howard's End and Passage to India and so on, he also wrote a science fiction story in 1909 called The Machine Stops. So this is my one bibliographical recommendation, is find The Machine Stops. It's freely available on the web. He predicts a future where we have the internet, we have iPads, we have video conferencing, we have MOOCs, so massive online open courses. And the machines are looking after every need of the human race, and we spend most of our time listening to MOOCs or giving lectures in MOOCs. And we eschew face-to-face contact with each other. We become obese because we spend all our time on the computer. So it's an amazing prediction for 1909. And what happens is that, of course, we become completely dependent on the machine. We no longer even know how it works. And that creates a kind of a fatal frailty in the human race. So we have to make, a very serious cultural effort, almost like Sparta in their effort to militarize their society. We need to make a cultural effort to retain our autonomy, our knowledge, just carrying forward our own civilization. Right, we've done that over history by teaching the next generation. If you add it up, it's a trillion person years of teaching and learning that we've put in to keeping our civilization going over time. Now we can actually stop doing that, because unlike paper, where we confide a lot of our knowledge to paper, but then it has to be read by another person. With machines, we can confide our knowledge to machines, and then they can run our civilization for us. So that's the big danger. We become passengers in a cruise ship that is cruising forever. And I don't think that's a future we want.
Fantastic. Some other questions? Yes, madam.
Thank you, Professor Russell, for a fascinating talk. Can I ask you, if we consider machine learning in AI, can any safeguards be incorporated into that so that vulnerable sections of society, voiceless, people who don't have a voice, maybe minorities, can be given some value, and it's not just the majority that we're considering, and there is an opportunity for, because of thinking of the whole of our population, dignity for, everyone has a voice.
I think there are a number of things that AI can do to benefit people. For example, the disabled, some already benefit from speech generation systems that allow Stephen Hawking to speak, for example. Wheelchairs that are more intelligent and don't require someone to push you around. Even language aids. So I spend time in Paris where I'm linguistically disabled, and I found AI machine translation systems to be extremely helpful in, for example, paying my taxes and things like that I just simply couldn't do with my limited French. So I believe that they can provide a great deal of help to people who may not have all of the advantages that other people have. It's also, I think, the point you're making is that the decisions that AI systems make are going to be based on data that's, largely reflects the majority population. And one of the things about machine learning algorithms is that if most of the data come from one group and a very small fraction comes from another group, the decision is going to be based on largely on the majority group. And again, we can devise technical solutions to this that will effectively tailor solutions not for one population, but actually realize that there are different subgroups. But there's a long way to go essentially disseminating an understanding of how to do this through all of the government agencies and financial institutions and so on that need to understand how this works properly.
A couple of questions at the front.
My name is Robert Woodfield from the One World Trust. One has a sense with AI that it is advancing so fast. I mean, it is thundering ahead, and yet we don't really have any brakes. And one projects, and you talked about Max Tegmark's book and his projections as to where that can lead. And I've done little surveys with friends with Tegmark's options and what you want. And basically, almost everybody wants something very similar to what we have now, whereas that doesn't look to be likely. And it seems to me, at the moment, we're going to find ourselves, if we're around, we're going to find ourselves in a situation where we say, if only, I didn't know it was going to be like this, if only we'd done something sooner. And it seems to me, at least we have to be able to have the control of how we develop. So if we go forward with a super intelligence, that we do it consciously because that's what we want, and we know what's going to come. And so in order to get there, it seems to me, to get that level of control, we're going to need a level of global governance, nothing that we do not have at all today. And so would you agree that is probably that what we do need, and that we should probably start to develop it now?
Very good. Thank you. And would you pass the microphone to the lady?
Hi, my name is Julia. I work in human resources. I have two questions. One is about the rights of citizens. So it appears, as the learning friend just said, that we seem to be racing to this. A lot of the private companies out there, they're simply going ahead and creating algorithm after algorithm. I'll take an example of driverless cars. Can we find ourselves in a situation where if you do not choose to buy a driverless car, your insurance premium would be very high, which basically means me as a citizen, I am forced, my choice, my freedom of choice is taken away from me. So I'd like to know, yes, because if I have to pay more, if I'm going to choose buy a manual car, I have to pay higher insurance, I don't have a freedom of choice. So what is the government doing about that? And my second question is around the contingency for people, because yes, we've touched on it very just now, the role of human beings, and you said we have a value to each other. However, you also said the AI are going to be designed so they're where they make themselves better and better, so they can learn to comfort us as well. And when all is said and done, when there's nothing to learn, there's nothing to do, there are no symphonies to write, there are no books to write, there's no poetry to write, what will we do, and what is the contingency? Are we heading to some sort of utopian future where we'll simply be making very difficult choices? What's the point of me hanging about, and what do I do?
So the meaning of life.
Okay, well, in 30 seconds or less. Okay, so let me, the first question on global governance. So most technologists will tell you, it's impossible to stop research, it's impossible to stop progress. Now that's actually not true. And there's an example from the field of genetic engineering when it was first realized that we had the ability to modify the genome. Back in the 1970s, a group of biologists got together and talked about the potential of this technology and also the risks. And from that, several things came. The regulations on safety of experiments, but also a moratorium on modification of the human genome. And that moratorium has remained in place pretty much until today. I mean, there are some gray areas about mitochondrial modification, but as a matter of fact, in more than 40 years, there have been no experiments in modifying the human genome in a heritable way. And the reason was because of the fear of creating a super race, of creating a biological division in the human race between those who were enhanced and those who weren't. And so it is possible, but that particular technology is a very, very specific kind of technology. It's very clear whether you have or haven't modified the human genome in a heritable way, and it's very clear what experiments you can ban, what medical products you can ban. AI is much, much harder to control, and there are many, many attempts right now to set up both national and global governance organizations, but there are far fewer ideas about what they would ban or what they would regulate or how they would regulate it, because you know, progress in AI happens by you know, dudes chugging Red Bull and people writing stuff on whiteboards. It's very hard to ban the writing of certain symbols on whiteboards. And at the same time, I completely agree. The technology, let's say that we cannot prevent the progress of this technology, and let's say that we fail to solve the problem that the lady raised, which is, what are we going to do when machines can do everything better than we can? It's hard to see what is the force that operates against the very strong economic force to develop this technology. You know, people talk a lot about, oh, well, you know, machines are not going to replace people, they're going to augment our capabilities. Yes, but the company that has a lot of humans working with machines is going to go out of business because it can't compete with the company that just has machines. And unless you revoke the laws of economics, it's hard to see how we fix that problem. So these are issues that we're going to have to address, and I would say the sooner the better. For once, we could try to have solutions in place before the fact rather than after the fact. And control is one of the problems I think we have a handle on, but the role of humans in the future, we still don't have a good picture of an economy that I would like my children to live in, where machines are doing pretty much everything we currently think of as work. And coming back to the ladies, so the question of what are humans going to do? So we already talked that about that a little bit. I think that we can have a very positive future. So if you think about how, you know, what have people done in their economic lives, I think it's probably not true of most of the people in this room, but ever since the beginning of agriculture, most people have been used as robots. That's been the life of almost everybody, is repetitive, tedious work that provides in itself no real intellectual stimulation, no real sense of achievement. You're simply doing what you're told 1,000 times a day for thousands of days until you die. And that period is coming to an end. I think it could end quite quickly. And we don't have a picture of what is a viable economy. As I said earlier, I think human-to-human relationships are going to be much, much more important as a source of value, because you know, material goods and services will be largely free. Whether that's enough, I don't know.
A note of uncertainty. Because of the time, I think we are going to leave it there for questions, but I would just like to ask one question to close. But before I do, I want to say an enormous thank you, Stuart, for coming over from Berkeley and for speaking with us. We'll have an opportunity to give you a round of applause in a moment. But I'd love to ask, the title of the series is Embracing Global Challenges. And I think we all have a sense of the scale of the challenge, the opportunity as well, globally, historically. But to focus on the embrace for a moment, I worry that AI is still so technical, so remote from people's experience as an activity, that it will still be done far away by experts, by governments. You've given an entreaty for people to read E.M. Forster as one of the takeaway actions for this evening. What else might we do? What action might we take to embrace this as a challenge, all of us in the room, rather than just to wait for the future to happen to us?
That's a great question. I would say that there are many books that are written now for the general public about AI. I'm actually writing one myself, which should be out sometime next year.
What's the title, Stuart?
So the title is probably Human Compatible. And what I mean by that is a sort of a very unsubtle dig at the rest of the AI community that are building AI that isn't compatible with human existence.
Buy your book, read E.M. Forster.
I think it's difficult to get engaged with the discussion unless you have some basic understanding. So let me give an analogy to medicine and bioethics. Medicine, like AI, is done by specialists. In fact, you know, when I try to read a paper in, you know, Nature that has any biological content, it's complete gibberish. You know, it's the names of 75 molecules, each of which runs over 2.5 lines, and I've no idea what they're talking about. But there are sources about that you can read about molecular biology that, you know, at least you understand that people have DNA, and that sometimes DNA replication goes wrong and there are mutations and so on. So you can then, if you have that basic understanding, you can understand what the ethical debates are about. Why might it be a good idea to allow human genome modification, or why might it not be a good idea to allow it? Or, you know, should we allow it just for correction of genetic defects? You know, and how do you distinguish between a genetic defect and an enhancement? So, you know, is baldness a genetic defect, and could we fix that in our children? You know, that's an interesting discussion. And I think that discussion should be something that everyone participates in, because it's really going to affect everybody. You know, if we had the option to have genetic enhancements done on your children before they're born, would you do that? You know, and do we want that even to be a question that is asked of every prospective parent? Perhaps not. Perhaps that's a slippery slope to the, you know, the future that you see in Gattaca and Blade Runner and so on, that we might find very, very undesirable. So, and the same is true of AI. Right, so if we understand AI as just some magic juice that boffins in California invent, then we feel powerless to make those decisions, because we simply don't understand what we're talking about. But if you learn a little bit, for example, if you learn, you know, what is machine learning, what is the effect of biased data, you know, what, you know, is it because the programmers are a bunch of racists and sexists? No, it's probably because the data that they're feeding their algorithms is reflecting the biases of society. And then what is the cost of fixing that, and what's the right policy? Those are questions that you could then start to engage in.
Opportunities to educate and to get engaged.
Yes, Stuart. And I think our politicians really need to learn this, because they are going to be faced with some of these decisions very soon.
Stuart, thank you so much.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Richard, for being such a fantastic interlocutor. I'm Claire Foster-Gilbert, the director of Westminster Abbey Institute, and I'm going to draw our autumn programme to a close. We've been asking questions. Have we killed the planet? Has migration overwhelmed us? Have the machines taken over? And the answer seems to be, in every case, not yet. So who are we to be then? And what are our institutions to be that, as we move into this future, the world that we emerge into is not a pitiless world, but a compassionate world? James Martin describes the 21st century as being like a canyon of all the stresses that are coming upon us in the next few decades. And he says, humanity is on rafts traveling through this canyon. What is the world going to be that we emerge into on the other side of the canyon? How can we ensure it's not pitiless, but that it's compassionate. And I think the answer came, interestingly, from the politician who spoke in our series in the symposium Humanity's Response. And he had a word for it about who we should be and what our institutions should be and what we should demonstrate. And that word was love. So that's where I think we're going to end our program. That's how we're going to embrace global challenges, with love. Thank you very much, everybody.